Some people have a gift of perfect recollection of their childhoods. You ask them who their teacher was in second grade, they remember the teacher, the classroom, what they taught, how they felt about it, who their friends were, who their friends weren't. Me, I remember nothing. I know I had a teacher in second grade. I know I passed. But when I want to remember something about my childhood, I call my brother. And I ask him, because I have a snapshot memory. I remember this moment and that moment, but I don't exactly remember when they were. I don't know which grade it was in that this happened. And were it not for the fact that my parents conveniently, every 5 years or so, moved houses, I wouldn't know what age range things happen at a particular home. But there is, actually there are a few, but in particular this morning I want to talk about one childhood memory that is more than a snapshot and is very vivid. And I know how old I was 8 years old. And it was the rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where I lived until I was 10, that the Jewish community held in the 67 war. And of course, I've been thinking about it this week, because this week in the English calendar and this past week in the Hebrew calendar were the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of that war. I remember the rally very well. I remember sitting with my brothers and with my mother as my father spoke and then the governor spoke. And there was a sense of tremendous frenzy and even excitement and charge among the Jewish community because, as far as we knew, Israel's life hung in the balance at every moment. And we had no idea at that time that this was going to be the Six-Day War, that this was going to be considered a great military triumph. What I didn't know at the time, of course, and would have been too young to understand in any case, is they didn't know that in Israel either. One of the advantages, of course, of seeing things later is that things seem inevitable, but the truth is, it was not inevitable. In a sort of review essay of various historians in the New Yorker, David Remnick takes us back to what that time was like and what it meant. He said in 67, meanwhile, rabbis were consecrating parks as cemeteries, and thousands of graves were dug, because that's what they were anticipating. In the press and in the cabinet, there were calls for the prime minister's resignation, and resignation of Eshkol not only as prime minister, but defense minister. Ben-Gurion was so worried about the possibility of a military coup that the military would take over from the government, that he issued a public warning from Sde Boker, his kibbutz in the Negev. That's how terrified Israel was and how uncertain they were that they would emerge from this hole. Remember, who was allied against Israel? Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Tunisia, Libya, Morocco. The entire world seemed to be against Israel. On May 26th, just a few days before the war, and I could multiply these quotations a hundredfold, but one will serve. Nasser, who was at the time, of course, the dictator of Egypt, said, "We intend to open a general assault against Israel. This will be total war. Our basic aim will be to destroy Israel." Now remember, as small as Israel is now, the Israel that was being slated for destruction was a sliver. It was tiny. There was no old city of Jerusalem. There was no West Bank. The Golan Heights were in Syria's hands, and if you've ever stood on the Golan Heights, it is as easy to hit someone from the Golan Heights as it would be for me to hit you from this bima in the congregation. It's right there. It is inconceivable to someone who lives in America how close the distances are in Israel. Los Angeles seems bigger than Israel, because there are places in Los Angeles that you can't get to. In Israel, everywhere. And even now, when we believe that the victory was seamless, the truth is it was anything but seamless. There were lots of mistakes and lots of wrong turns and lots of last-minute escapes. As Saul Singer wrote in the Jerusalem Post this past week, if there were a Winograd Commission, which is the commission that looked into the Lebanon War, for the 67 War, the report would be just as harsh. But nobody appoints commissions for victories. You only appoint commissions for defeats. If you manage to win, everything's okay. And we managed to win. And now 40 years later, we live with all the consequences of that astonishing and remarkable victory. And that leads to a meditation on the number 40. As everybody here knows, 40 is a very powerful number in the Bible. Let me just give you a few examples. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. The Israelites wander in the desert for 40 years. Moses is 40 years old when he goes to confront the Egyptian taskmaster, and he is twice 40, 80 years old, the first time he goes to confront Pharaoh. To move ahead, Rabbi Akiva, the greatest scholar of the Talmud, was 40 years old when he began his study of Judaism. And if you didn't know that, doesn't that give us all hope? He didn't know the alphabet. He didn't know the Hebrew alphabet until he was 40. And he became the most important rabbi in our history. Leaflets for adult education will be available. And here's what struck me as I looked through, as I scrolled through these various 40 events. These events that are tied to this powerful symbolic number in our tradition, which is that while all of them have a triumphant side, they also, each of them has a tragic side. The flood, I don't have to tell you. 40 days and 40 nights resulted in the devastation of the world. And the reason that we teach, when we teach this story, the reason that we teach children about Noah's Ark, every time, right, you walk through a preschool, you always see Noah and all the animals. What don't you see? You don't see the destruction and death that the flood caused. But as adults, we have to realize that that 40 days and 40 nights had a terrible shadow side as well. Moses, in his confrontation with the Egyptian taskmaster at age 40, had to flee and run away, because he was afraid for his life. His confrontation with Pharaoh led to the wandering in the wilderness. And as we read in the Torah portion this morning, the wilderness was not an easy time for the Israelite people. It was a time of difficulty and of trial and of pain and of suffering. And when they came to the Promised Land, and this is one of the great illusions of Jewish history, the Promised Land then was no picnic either. Just read the book of Joshua and the book of Judges. The conquest of Israel was a difficult and battle-scarred and gradual process. And Rabbi Akiva, he began studying at 40, but remember that in the Hadrianic persecutions, because he refused to give up his studies, he was killed. He was martyred. so that even the Jewish learning of the great Jewish sage has a dark side. And that brings us to today. Every article that I have read about Israel's Six-Day War, and there have been many, and you'll see in this week there'll be lots more, and I invite you to apply this test. Every one of them talks about the difficult consequences that have resulted from the conquest that Israel achieved 40 years ago. The problem of the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, take your pick, it's the same place, whatever you call it. The problems of Jerusalem, the difficulties of Sinai before we returned Sinai to Egypt, and the difficulties even of the cold peace between Egypt and Israel. To what extent all of this contributes to the radicalization of the Islamic world, or to what extent it doesn't? Whether were it not for the Six-Day War, would we be facing a nuclear Iran today, or would we not? All of these things are endlessly parsed in the press. But here's the question that I actually don't see asked so often. You see, one of the things that we tend to do is compare what is to a perfect imagined world. But such a world never was. And what I want to know is not what are the consequences of Israel's victory, but what would have been the consequences had Israel lost? What if there had been no 67 war? What if we hadn't fought so well? Or what if the Arab nations had not declared war in 67 and had waited until they were better prepared and declared war 10 years later or 20 years later? When Egypt would have been just as intent on destroying us as Nasser was in 1967. What would have happened then? Does anyone imagine for a moment that things would have been better had Israel not won in 1967? And not just for Israel, but for the world. Remember, without the victory of Israel in 1967, there is no destruction of the Iraqi nuclear reactor. Actually, without the victory of Israel in 1967, there probably is no Israel. And do you imagine that the Middle East would be a calm and stable and peaceful place, were it just not for the presence of that pesky Jewish state in the middle of things? This is the question we have to ask. Was the wandering for 40 years difficult? Yes, it was difficult, but what if the Jews had never left Egypt? Would things be better? Rabbi Akiva met a very difficult end, but what if, God forbid, there had been no Rabbi Akiva? What we have to realize is that Jewish history teaches that there is no blessing without a shadow side. There is no love without loss. There is no friendship without pain. There is no victory without regret. As Wellington once said, and he certainly would know, having won the Battle of Waterloo, the only thing worse than a great victory is a great defeat. Israel won a great victory, and it brings its difficulties and its trials, but God knows it is better than a great defeat. In this same week that we celebrate this, things have become difficult yet again. First of all, they are difficult in the court of world opinion. To its everlasting shame, and to, I hope, the disgust of all decent people, the British university system, as you may know, has decided to boycott academics from Israel. Not, say, from Sudan, where there's a genocide, but from Israel. And of course, in the past 2 weeks, according to the New York Times, which is from time to time an unimpeachable source, over 270 rockets have fallen on the city of Sderot in 2 weeks. Imagine, and now the city of Sderot is tiny. Imagine what would happen if 270 rockets fell on Westwood and Beverly Hills in 2 weeks. Imagine what it would do to our psyches and to that of our children. And you can imagine the devastation in that city in Israel. It's coming from the Gaza Strip, of course. But I am sure that scholars that are launching the rockets are welcome in the universities in Britain. So when we look back at that time and realize that it has consequences that are difficult to live with, we should accept that. When people point out that Israel made mistakes, sometimes awful mistakes, in the last 40 years between 1967 and now, we shouldn't be defensive. We should say, rather, if you can point me to any group of people or any nation, even that's under no pressure, that in the past 40 years has not made mistakes, then I will be astounded and disbelieving. But here is what we do know, that it is only that miraculous deliverance that allowed us to stay alive. And what I didn't know at age 8 was what the world was like before Israel. I couldn't feel, or at least I could just begin to feel, what was in the hearts of all those people who stood on their feet for 2 hours as they applauded speaker after speaker who talked about the necessity to save our land. Because, you see, I didn't have the memories that they had. I didn't know what it was to know a world where Jews were scattered and helpless and alone. But here's the message of 40 years. Israel and the Jewish community around the world, for that moment, rallied to the side of a nation that was beleaguered and somehow helped it to save itself. And even though everything has changed, nothing has changed. Even though Israel may be militarily dominant today, history doesn't allow for permanence. And there are some very terrifying storm clouds on the horizon. And it doesn't matter how dominant you are militarily, if you're a child in Sderot, it doesn't feel that way. So what I look back on mostly, what I am filled with, is a sense of gratitude. Because I know that that rally was not unique, that there were rallies all across America and all across the world. Because Jews realized that we could not give up the last best hope for the Jewish people, the State of Israel. And it is our task today to ensure that the same is true. That by our visits, by our money, and by our voice, we let the world know that the same sort of unanimity that prevailed 40 years ago is still alive today. That we still love that tiny land, and we will not let it die. We are now the children and the grandchildren of the decisions that were made in 1967. And 40 years from now, people will be saying the same about the decisions that were made in 2007. They will remember that the Jewish community stood with Israel or that it did not. God help us if we don't, because our children and grandchildren rightly will not forgive us. But if we do, maybe they'll have a memory, as I do, of a moment in which we realized what was at stake. And we didn't call the land perfect, but we did call it ours. And we promised to the Jews of Israel, to ourselves, and to God, that we will never let it go. Shabbat Shalom.